I was reading what I thought was a really bad interview with you. It was in print, and it goes about 5-6 years ago. And I was like, these are just really bad questions. She's got to be bored. She's got to be like, you know, she's got to be just like, get me out of here type of thing. So, you know, you were the one I really wanted to speak to.
That's really cool of you. Thank you, you know, very much. I appreciate it, and I do like talking about rock and roll and the fact, you know, like Alan and Mark and Martha have been a little more diplomatic about MTV than me, but it's like, I can't even be diplomatic about it. It sucks.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, it's like, how can I?
That'll be my trailer clip.
Yeah, you should use that. Yeah, how can I be diplomatic when the damn thing
Holy
sucks?
Shit, man.
You know, it's a bunch of crapola. Who watches this stuff? You know,
that's
my rant. Yeah, see, this person could deal with Frank Zappa. The one back years ago couldn't. What the hell's wrong with you?
Bad news, but only if you're out of me. Bad news, but only if you wanna be. You can lose.
Rise and fall of MTV.
So she was pretty open about.
Oh yeah.
You know, the questions you were asking. Like,
yeah,
you know,
she doesn't hide the fact that MTV sucks now.
Unfortunately, I didn't get to make the interview. I was supposed to, I feel horrible about that because one of my questions would have been, and I don't know if he asked her this or not, but you know, these guys were like rock stars themselves, the VJs,
right?
So, you know, as a female VJ like that, is there like a groupie scene? You know what I mean? I wasn't going to get explicit
or anything
like that.
I got into a little bit of the
I wouldn't be explicit about it.
Being that they
respectful.
Were exposed to all of this craziness and being yeah. right there.
Like
and
a musician,
many
the
of
sex,
them,
the drugs,
many
the rock and roll.
Partying with yeah, them. You know, right. There's the legendary stories of Mark Goodman, you know, in the backstage area at the US Festival with yeah. David Lee Roth, you know.
Live Aid was another big thing.
Right. There was all that. So there was one question that I kind of threw that somebody wanted me to ask her. I wasn't going to ask her, but I did. And, you know, so we kind of went very quickly through the history of MTV, went from its relevance, its initial launch, through the whole relevance, through when it was very a vital part of pop culture and it informed pop culture.
Did you ask her about any of the other VJs? Most of them are on Sirius XM now as DJs.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah. she's doing, I think they do 80s on 8.
Yeah, and Mark Goodman is, Alan Hunter was, Mark Goodman.
Yeah.
Nina is, I think Nina does something from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, or near the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, well,
she's
an Ohio girl.
Oh, there you go.
And we talked a lot about her growing up in Ohio. This is it's really good stuff. So without further ado, my conversation with Nina Blackwood.
Wait, back it up.
All right.
I just wanted to ask you one question. Who personally was your favorite VJ from the original MTV cast? Who was your personal favorite?
Being that Nina's going to be listening to this.
I love you, Nina. This is Pat, and I do love you. I absolutely do. I enjoy your radio. Your radio voice is spectacular. But my personal favorite was JJ. I just think he had that deep, soothing, soulful voice, and JJ was always one of my favorite VJs.
You know what? I say this all kidding aside, all total honesty. I didn't have a favorite.
Okay.
I didn't have a Fair. Favorite. I liked all of them for various different reasons, man. Even the nerdy Alan Hunter had his like own little, you know, little charms. I really liked all of them for various reasons.
So now you can do so your now, without further yeah. ado. But Nina, I do love you. It was just a curious question.
She was the most mysterious one to me, Nina Blackwood. Hmm. So, Nina Blackwood.
Animal rights stuff, because that's my passion until this last election, and now it's become, fuck you!
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, get the guy out! What the fuck?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a lot of, it morphed into, because I can't keep quiet about the mess.
It's like conversations like this that I would love. You know, it's like I'm doing these things, and it's like very specific things, like Retrospeak. This is for MTV, and then there's Rock Under Fire. And I have these like also like these great conversations with people that don't make the cut. And I'm like, I'm thinking about actually doing something called Derico Untitled, where I just have these, you know, just like anything goes conversations, and just posting like this will be Nina Blackwood for Retrospeak, and then I'll put the whole fucking thing.
I've never been so angry or sworn so much in my entire life. I post stuff, but he's the guy.
Like
that,
your Twitter, you have like you always have a couple of songs each day.
No, I don't do Twitter.
Not Twitter. Was it? What the hell am I thinking of then? That has like. Are you sure you don't have a Twitter? Does somebody have a Twitter for you?
I do have a Twitter account, but I don't. I've never tweeted in my life.
Does somebody tweet for you? I just want to hit on just certain aspects of MTV's influence in the beginning, and you know, just when it was really when it was most relevant. In other words, you know.
Yeah.
So you have this entity in 1981. Through which, you know, branches kind of extend outward in all directions, and it informs what we're going to listen to and how we're going to look and how we're going to dress and how we're going to wear our hair for the, you know, the better part of two decades. And it's all launched with the words, ladies and gentlemen, rock and roll.
Right.
Would that fly today? Would that introduction fly today?
Well, unfortunately, rock and roll... is not at the forefront anymore with music. You kind of said that when we started speaking. You know, it's much more of a pop world these days. So, I mean, I don't even think it could be sad today. Rock and roll. I mean, and I really hate to say that because I'm a rock and roller. I mean, I grew up with rock and roll. That's my favorite kind of music.
You grew up with WMMR. Was it MMR?
No, I was not with them. I grew up listening to them.
No, well, that's what I meant. You grew up listening to them in Cleveland.
Yeah, WMMS in Cleveland.
Okay.
Which was, for years, the number one rock channel. I keep saying channel. That's what we call them on Sirius. We call them channels. It's station.
Yeah.
Rock and roll station in the country, and Cleveland broke a lot of artists. So, you know, I was really lucky that I grew up there because that's where I heard, I mean, everybody, Bowie, you know, from A to Z, they all played Cleveland, and I went to see all of them. I grew up listening to the station. But, you know, that was... You know, really until, you know, the 90s, rock and roll was at the forefront. But, you know, and then you got, you know, rap, hip hop and pop kind of took over. Mm-hmm. And I'm really sorry about that. I really am. Rock and roll is just, you know, it's for real rock and rollers. It's in your soul. I mean, it's part of it. How can you even explain it? You know, it's just rock and roll or rock.
Yeah, you know, and at the time it was so big, yet it was so big that it was the foundation of this channel that exploded. In just a very short period of time. Now let me ask you, like, it seems to me that the first initial impact of MTV was in the first 18 to 24 months was that it brought in a second British invasion. It had in common like an extension of New Wave. You know, we had New Wave at the tail end of the 70s and into 1980 here in the States. And then it kind of fizzled out for a little bit, at least, you know, on the pop charts for a while. And then MTV comes into the picture and you have this cluster of bands bringing in. It was like a much more, I guess, sweeter, soulful brand of new wave. So you had bands like Duran Duran and The Fix and ABC, Flock of Seagulls.
Right.
Eurythmics.
Right.
The Thompson Twins. What was going on at the outset of MTV that the majority of those videos were coming from overseas?
Well, pretty much because Europe and especially, you know, the UK were making videos. They were ahead of the game American bands weren't making videos, but Europe was making videos because they started out basically as a promotional tool within, like, the industry. And then that's how the seed came about for MTV, because, you know, the founders thought, you know, here are these promotional video clips. Why don't we have a channel that plays them? But they were basically industry promotional clips. They weren't for airing necessarily. So that's why it was kind of the supply was coming from over there. So they were head and shoulders ahead of the U.S. in making videos.
I remember seeing Tom Petty on Merv Griffin, and it was Refugee, and it just speaks to the fact that, like you just said, there were these disposable promotional things, and like probably meant to only be used once. And some artists, I think, I don't know if Tom Petty spoke to this once, but it just videos were this way out of having to actually appear on talk shows. And he was told he was going to be on Merv Griffin, but he didn't want to go. He didn't want to do the show. And, you know, it was just things you would see on talk shows and things like Solid Gold. I remember Solid Gold showed a lot of videos. But yeah, they just didn't seem to be taking the format seriously at first. And then again, MTV. Obviously, there's some growing pains the first few years. The channel, after its first year, I think, lost something like $50 million. It sent executives scrambling around. They're appealing to celebrities like Mick Jagger and trying to get him to come on board for their ad campaign, which was very successful. You know, mm-hmm. I want my MTV.
Right.
As VJs, how privy were you to the business end while all of this was going on? Were you showing up to work not knowing how much longer you'd have a job? Were they telling you that, you know, this could go, we've reached a point where this can go one way or the other? What was going on?
Like, they didn't. No. You know, when I took the job, and you have to remember, you know, a lot of people that weren't around at the time don't realize that cable was also in its infancy. You know, it wasn't like it is now. So, you know, when I'm going off to this video music channel on cable, you know, we didn't know, you know, if I'd be there 6 months or, as it turned out, 6 years, you know. So it wasn't so, we just didn't know, you know. It was a gamble. And everybody that worked there at the beginning, you kind of took it as that. That's where it was kind of like a pioneer situation. But, you know, little by little, it was catching on in the middle part of the country, because it wasn't even in New York or L.A. when it started. It took a couple of years. And then once it did hit the major cities like New York and L.A., you know, it was no stopping it. I mean, it was just the train came out of the station. But on a day-to-day basis, no. You know, we did what we were doing in the studios, which was separate from the offices. They were on 6th Avenue. We were down you know, between 10th and 11th, for crying out loud, really seedy part of town. So we just did what we were supposed to do every day, you know. Of course, there'd be articles out, and we knew the channel wasn't making money. That was just the way it was. But we never, at least I could say for myself, I wasn't worried that, oh, tomorrow I'm going to be out of a job. I didn't think of it that way. We figured there was so much passion, or I'll say I figured there was so much passion and forward motion with it that it would just keep going, you know, just from sheer being tenacious, you know, that it would keep. So no, I didn't worry. But the downside for us, I remember we were, you know, we needed advertising. That we all knew, because companies were very leery about buying time on a cable music channel for obvious reasons, right? And I remember I got an offer It was for a skincare product through Procter & Gamble. And I was so excited because I was going to be like the spokesperson. And they were going to buy time on the channel. And I felt like the cat that came back with the mouse to my owner, like, look, 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 look. And I could not believe it. They would not let me do it. And I'll never forget that because I thought, but you need advertising. But nope, they didn't want to let me do it, you know, and it was like, okay. So obviously, Procter & Gamble's pretty big. So I guess they figured that they could live without Procter & Gamble at the time and keep going. So that's kind of a long answer to the question. No, I didn't think that we were going to go under right away. Because when you have that kind of attitude, you'll like, but don't you need advertising money?
Sure. That's what it's about. You know, it's, as far as MTV getting that money,
it was kind of weird. I remember being very disappointed about that because obviously I lost a lot of money, but,
and so did probably MTV.
That's right. And that, I think, you know, I didn't, I actually, because I remember when the call came from one of the executives.
Well, probably for some, like, exclusivity clause in your contract or something, right?
Well, there was. Yeah. And I would never sign another one of those again.
Yeah.
That they had to approve of anything outside of MTV. But we did. We went through the channels. Not meaning the channels, but, you know, the proper channels, I should say. Whether they could have said yes or no, and they could have easily said yes. And they said no.
You mentioned once in an interview about the occasional mismatching of artist and VJ, where if it wasn't the right pairing, it could lead to disaster.
Yeah.
Right now, you and me are both thinking of Frank Zappa.
Yeah.
You know that. that aside, that period where MTV was being criticized for not playing enough black artists. Now, I wouldn't say that this was a case of being mismatched, but I mean the luck of Mark Goodman having to sit across from David Bowie that day.
And again, you know, I've got to still defend MTV about that. It was not a question of race. It was a question of musical genre.
You were a rock and roll channel.
We were a rock and roll channel, and because there were artists that were black that we were playing.
Sure.
Bill Linnett, Joan Armatrading, John Butcher, Axis. It was just, there weren't that many black rock artists. So if the racism came about, it was kind of point to the record labels, you know, not to us. So I can really say that I never, ever felt that it was a question of race whatsoever.
Yeah.
And truly, like Michael Jackson was an R&B artist, a Motown R&B artist, but his music did start changing. I mean, with Eddie Van Halen, Steve Stevens, you know, it got rockier. And, you know, what, there have been so many stories about that whole thing with Michael Jackson and who said what. To be quite honest, I don't really know what the truth is because, you know, there's just been so many different stories.
What's that in reference to?
Michael Jackson being played on.
Oh, you mean at first? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. But
anyway, no, I did not feel it was a racist question.
You know,
at all. And I would be, because I'm very sensitive about that, I would have been the first, JJ would have been the first, for crying out loud, to say something. I mean, but I would have been a close second, you know. Wait a minute.
It's funny because I don't even remember that, and I used to watch a lot of MTV. You know, we all did. It was, you know, MTV, I was 11 years old in its first year. We didn't get it until like 1982, a year later, exactly 1 year after its, you know, launch. So mm-hmm. I don't even remember that being an issue. I mean, I don't know if maybe because I didn't, you know, read the papers or there was no internet and access to news didn't travel as quick, but word of mouth did not get around like that as much. So I remember hearing nothing about this and just looking back, you know, years later hearing about this.
And I was kind of surprised at that interview, that how alone. I mean, I felt, and it's forever ingrained on the internet for Mark. You know, it's like one of those.
Yeah.
Wow.
That could have been That could have been any of you guys. You know.
Yes, it could have.
Oh man.
And
that's why I was going to ask you specifically about Frank Zappa. You know, that was just a bad. That was just another bad one that I'm not going to.
Why? And I was so. I mean, now I swear, and I'm a lot, you know, more. I didn't even swear. I was so sensitive.
Yeah.
I mean, it should have been Mark or JJ. You know, it should have been, you know, either one of those. Not Martha, not Alan.
You're like thrown into this pool of sharks and they just told you to swim.
Yeah, and it's like, why is this person being so... And I knew about that, but it's not like, you know, I didn't know that he was like, you know, that he was. But when he's... I didn't have the tools at the time to come back at him, and it was... I compare it to a bully in a schoolyard picking on, you know, the shy girl.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The wallflower. Yeah. Because that's basically what I was. I still am to a certain extent, wallflower. I'm the one in the corner. You know, it was just really unfair, and I know he was getting, you know, he thought he was real funny, and it was really an unfair. I don't like bullies, let's put it that way. And he was a bully.
Yeah.
You know, now I probably would have sworn at him and said, get the fuck out of here. You know, but I've changed.
Yeah. We all do. Oh man, I don't know that he would have played JJ that way or Mark.
He wouldn't.
You know, I doubt that.
Mark, maybe he would have tried, but JJ, no way.
Yeah.
No way. You're talking about an ex-Marine? Hardly.
Yeah.
You know?
Mark's seen some tougher shit. You know, Mark was, if I remember correctly, he was in doing New York radio the night that he had to announce that John Lennon had been shot. So there are tougher things than Frank Zappa.
Yeah.
I have to put this one out there because we can't go through the trajectory of the early years without talking a little bit about Thriller. We know how it impacted the pop charts, the trends on the pop charts, album sales. What was the overall impact of MTV on MTV, on videos in general? Because it was indeed a game changer.
Well, I think they got a lot more elaborate after that. And I know leading up to this event, the world premiere, oh my God. It was weeks and weeks, you know, promoting this thing. It was like the second coming, you know, it really was. You know, and still, you know, brilliant piece of film, brilliant music, the whole thing. So as technology advanced and artists of all different, the directors, producers, choreographers, set designers, costume people, you know, it just hit its stride in the mid-80s. Video music is what I'm talking about, videos. You know, there was so much creativity.
New videos became events.
Yeah.
Trailers and advertisements for weeks leading up to a world premiere video.
Yes.
Everybody started like trying to outdo each other.
Or Peter Gabriel, the world premiere, we're going to... Yeah, but Thriller was, you know, huge. Such a big event.
You once also spoke about seeing things up ahead regarding, you know, let me think of how to phrase this one. You know, the pieces, characteristics of what makes something so unique and special always turns a corner at some point. And it's usually when something hits its peak, you know, the honeymoon always ends, so to speak. We could debate till we're blue in the face what that corner was for MTV. Some might say Remote Control. Some might say the beginning of the VMAs. Some might say the sale to Viacom in 1985. What changes did you see happening where you foresaw that what was up ahead?
Well, it actually was the last year that I was there. You could kind of feel it. Nothing real specific, because while I was there, remote control. I left before remote control. But I can't point to one particular thing while I was there, because I left in 86. And that's right about the time that it started changing. And to be quite honest, I was so busy with my jobs. I had like 3 gigs, simultaneously out in L.A. So I was so busy, I didn't pay a lot of attention to MTV. Because
at that point, where they were leaving you alone at that point, so you were doing other things and they tended to...
Oh, I left. No, I left. I left to take...
Oh, I thought while you were doing MTV in 1986.
Oh, no. I left MTV in 1986. So it was before they had remote control. I think remote control might have started in 86. So I left before the major changes started and was doing Entertainment Tonight, Solid Gold, a syndicated radio show through United Stations. So that's why I didn't really pay attention to MTV when I was gone, because I was too busy, to be quite honest. You know, I was busy doing my own things.
Right.
So I can't really speak to, you know, what happened after I left whatsoever. But when I was there, which kind of gave me the impetus to finally leave, it was just a feeling. You sensed that things were changing. You just sensed that it was becoming a little more restricted. Our roles as VJs, they started a whole separate news department. So the things that we, our duties kind of were getting lesser, if you can understand what I'm trying to say. Because some of these,
it's almost like going from a
gold
like...
offer, and I had gotten a lot of offers that I said no to, because I would have had to leave MTV and I wasn't ready to. It was like a family, you know, and I go, nah, not yet. And finally with that, you know, it's just a feeling I had inside.
Right.
You know, that's when I finally said, okay, now it's time to graduate and go into the real world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did. But I know, you know, the Viacom thing certainly had something to do with it. The original, like Bob Pittman, left. The other executives who really were there, this was their baby. And even though they were on the executive side and the business side, they loved MTV. They loved the music. They loved everything about it. You know, that's why they hung in there when it wasn't making any money. You don't do that if you don't have a passion for it. You know, it's just not smart. So I think that's when it really started changing, and then they started the reality shows and all that. But, you know, I'm not the person to ask about that on a daily basis, because I wasn't there.
Right. MTV's current relevancy, quote-unquote relevancy, has been questionable for the past 20 or so years, probably more. Does it continue to inform pop culture in different mediums now, or has it just become reflective of pop culture?
I don't even... I to be quite honest, I don't even know what the relevance... I know that sounds cold.
No. I agree with you. I just wanted to throw it out there.
I was talking to somebody recently, you know, and this sounds terrible, but, I mean, if it was still music-based, I would be watching it.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, it's I could probably say something a lot more terrible. In a sense, that
you know,
it's just...
I don't even, to be quite honest, I don't even know what channel it is on the.
When I started putting this together, somebody mentioned MTV, and I was like, that's still a thing, like, is that still?
No, and they don't make any. I mean, they're not making any money. I was talking just recently about, you know, I understand that it had to evolve and change, but it still could have been music-based and been successful, you know, with different interview shows, on-site, you know, kind of like what, I don't know if you listen to Sirius XM.
I do.
Kind of like, Yeah, kind of like what SiriusXM, the various channels do. You know, they have the specials at the Apollo Theater, you know, with whether it be U2 or a Tom Petty listening party, you know. It still could have been doing those things. And if you want a couple of reality game show, whatever, yeah, you know, fine. But to do away with what it actually started out as, you know, music-driven, to me, makes no sense.
Where this culture of celebrities and where, you know, at one time, you know, where we had music and we had movies and we had all these different aspects of society and civilization and all happening at the same time. And you had things like the Star and the National Enquirer. But right now we're living inside the National Enquirer. It's kind of like MTV with the reality shows and making celebrities out of anybody. In a sense, it's become just another symptom in a dumbing down of civilization.
You know, yeah,
that's just,
I mean,
I told you my criticism was much more harsh than yours.
I would have actually preferred that they just retired the name MTV. Just, okay, this was something cool that happened for a couple of decades. See you later. Than to use MTV for the crapola. You know,
yeah.
For lack of a better term, but it's just
it doesn't even stand out anymore. It's just become another symptom of everything that's going on right now, of what's become of pop culture in general. I think, unless I'm just one of those get off my lawn people at the age of 48, I don't know. I don't want to be that person, but it's.
No, you're not. I mean, both you and I love, you know, rock and roll, and we love music. And if it was viable, why would I not watch it?
Yeah,
I would watch it. But how can I watch crap? Yeah. You know, it's like I never liked reality, you know, from the start. I just, you know, because it's not really reality. Reality shows are documentaries. I barely watch TV anyway. I like to read.
Yeah.
I'm more of a book person. But
Let me throw some really quick things at you that are a little bit less prefaced.
I get angry.
Yeah,
to be quite honest, I do. I get angry
at that topic, or just the long-winded questions.
No, I get angry about you know,
of what it's become.
Yes, you know, it's like, yeah, I know it had to change, but you have to go all the way into the gutter.
Yeah.
It's the same anger I feel what happened to our country. But
oh,
we won't get into politics.
Yeah, I have a feeling I have a feeling we're in agreement with some things.
Yeah, it's like, how can you know that? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, when some friends, you know, found out I was talking to you today, they wanted me to ask you some of the things that I didn't want to ask you, because you're probably asked 6 billion times. Oh, tell me about the 80s and tell me about this and how great were the 80s and how, you know, but let me give you this one, and then I'll just throw a few of my own. Just your most, given that you were very young and you're thrown into this world where you have access to rock stars and you're living in an epicenter of total debauchery at times, what was your most starstruck rock star moment?
You know, I really didn't.
Did you have one?
No. In a nutshell. Because it was part of our job, and because I'm a musician. I mean, and I was always around. I was either in a band or around musicians.
You just see them as people.
Yeah.
They're just people.
It wasn't like, you know, probably the closest came, Martha and I both huge Beatles fans, right? And probably the closest that it came to that was Paul McCartney had a movie, Give My Regards to Broad Street. I don't know if you remember that.
I remember that well. There was MTV was very much behind that in 1984.
Yeah. And so, you know, we went to the premiere and there was a big party. And of course, Paul is there. And, you know, I mean, we've interviewed everybody, you know, between Martha and I and Alan, Mark, and JJ. And Paul McCartney was there. And both Martha and I, who are not like this, we turned into 12-year-old girls. Like, you go up and see him. No, you go up. No, you go up and say hi. No, you go up and... Neither one of us could go up and say hi to Paul McCartney. That was probably the biggest thing of, but it's Paul McCartney.
Sure.
You know? Sure. I was going to marry him. I changed, and over the years, I loved George. George was closer to the type of person I am, but... You know, when they first came out, I was marrying Paul. Are you kidding? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Most girls were. And
I was a John and George. Then, I was about John and George.
George, George.
He's got the best solo album of all of the Beatles,
George
too.
George is the guy. George. I mean, all of them. But for me, he was closer to my soul.
Yeah.
But then years later, Martha got to interview him, and years later, after MTV, his manager had me host a press conference with Paul. So I got to actually, you know, later on, meet him, and it was fine. You know, that initial little girl thing, you know, was not there at this press event, you know, and I actually was speaking with him, and Linda was there, and he kept calling me Goldie because he thought I looked like Goldie Hawn.
Oh, shit. Really?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he was doing it on purpose. I mean, he knew my name. He just, you know how he personifies the word cheeky to this day. He's cheeky.
Yeah.
You know, he's just cheeky. But I do remember after it was all over, he kissed my cheek. And I remember running to the payphone. It was payphones back then. It wasn't cell phones yet. And going, Paul McCartney kissed my cheek. You know, it was like, did I ever think, you know, when I was like, you know, a little girl, he would kiss my cheek. I thought I was going to marry him. But that was the closest. But the other, the one, and I was just talking about this earlier this morning, the person that I got excited about, not starstruck, but I thought was just kind of blew me away, was at the first Farm Aid. I was getting ready to go on stage. I think it was to introduce Joe Walsh, if I remember correctly. I'm standing by the side of the stage. It was in Indiana, I believe, somewhere in the Midwest. And Jesse Jackson walks up to me and introduces himself. And I'm like, Jesse Jackson knows who I am? You know, it was more like that. It wasn't starstruck. It was like, wow, you know, because Jesse Jackson's Jesse Jackson.
That's very cool.
Yeah, it was like, wow, you know, because you don't think, you know, that Jesse Jackson is hanging around watching MTV. I mean, you know, he's a legend, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and he was very active in politics, and he was very much in the, I guess in September, so Farm Aid, September 85, a couple months after Live Aid. So, yeah, that places him right in the center of his public.
That's right.
You know, because he ran again in 88.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just watching the stage getting ready, you know, for the stage manager to say, go, you know how they do it. And I'll never forget, he just walked up to me with his hand extended, as if I don't know he's Jesse Jackson. You know, I'm just, and it's a pleasure. I like your work. It was like, oh, I couldn't wait to tell my mom. I was like, it was like, wow. It was just really cool. That was a nice little thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. First concert you ever attended. Now, again, I'm sure this has got to be before MTV. Maybe growing up in Cleveland.
Yeah. Geez. First one was The Who. Back in Cleveland, mm-hmm. Public Auditorium. And my high school brother's, I mean, my high school sweetheart's older brother's band opened up for The Who. So I saw The Who, and then I think the second one was Cream, which was Cream and Canned Heat. Cream were like outrageously good.
Wow.
Bowie, right from the, I think I was second row. I mean, you know, and tickets were so cheap, you know, like $2 or something like that. The one I wasn't allowed to go see, though, I was too young, and my mom, I wanted to go see Hendrix, and my mother wouldn't allow it because, to quote her, he does naughty things to his guitar, unquote.
Sure.
So
it would have been the case with Elvis, too, if you 10 years before.
I was not allowed to see Jimi Hendrix, which I really wanted to. But other than that, you know, I got to see just about anybody.
Yeah, Jimmy burns his guitar. Pete Townsend only breaks his, so you can go and see The Who.
Well, Jimmy, he was talking about his sexual.
I got you.
Not
okay.
His burning of the guitar.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, if he only burned the guitar, maybe she would have let me go, but it was the other. And the fact he even knew that is actually mind-blowing now that I'm telling you. How did she know that?
I don't know, because, again, there was no...
But she did, because I was not allowed to go to see Jimi Hendrix, but I got to see, I mean, anybody that I liked, basically, that went through Cleveland. And one of the, there was a cool place called the Cove in Cleveland that was actually underground. You know, you'd take steps to go in. And the Velvet Underground used to play there a lot. And, you know, I used to see them with a fake ID.
Damn.
Yes.
I didn't, yeah, you know, I didn't know, like, I figured, like, I was, like, I thought, like, well, never mind. I'm not going to say anything. I was going to say, you're old enough to have seen the Velvet Underground?
Yeah.
That's what I was going to say, Cream. I said the same thing with Cream. I'm thinking, like, all right, you saw The Who. I'm thinking maybe 1979 or something, but you saw The Who back when,
oh,
you know.
No. I mean, I grew up, like I said.
Wow.
I mean, I grew up with rock and roll. I mean.
Right, but I'm saying, like, you were a baby when you were on MTV.
Well, and I was a baby when I went to these places.
Wow.
I had a fake ID, and they were really easy to get, and I was actually a really good kid. I really was, except for I did get a fake ID because I liked seeing bands and clubs I wasn't old enough to get into. And, you know, I was friends with some musicians that were older than me by a couple of years. And we go to this Lacav. You know, they had 3-2 beer, you know, didn't even have, you know, the real stuff, and, you know, we'd sit in a smoky, cool place. And that's when I actually quit cheerleading because, you know, obviously the acts are on the weekends, and if I had to cheer for football or see the Velvet Underground, mm-hmm. you know, I knew my priority, and I actually quit cheerleading so I could go see these bands. Yeah, well, you know, I had my priorities on straight.
Rock and roll, baby.
Yeah.
Favorite, all-time favorite album?
Oh, God, that's almost impossible. That really is.
Does it depend on the day?
I think the first one that just jumps in my mind, a good friend of mine, gave me a frame of it is Rubber Soul. I guess that would have to be.
Okay.
Yeah, I just loved Rubber Soul.
Band.
What?
Band and artist. Favorite, all-time favorite band, all-time favorite artist.
Okay, I'd have to say, you know, of course I love the Beatles.
Right.
The Beatles were the most influential on me growing up, no question. You know, obviously, they broke up, so they're not around. But a band that's still around that I still love are the Stones.
Yeah, you and me both.
Yeah, Stones. No question. I mean, Jagger, oh, my God. You know?
Yeah, to be doing what he's doing. There's no distinction in the way he moves now than the way he did in his 20s and 30s.
Not much. And I would put, you know, these... You know, people go, oh, I don't think that's me, the old man, you know. It's like I would put Jagger up against a 20-something-year-old front man.
Yeah.
You know, and he'd outdance him. I mean, he's like the rock and roll Baryshnikov.
He was actually much more constrained back in the 70s because he was constrained by a wire. He had a wire on his mic. So once microphones went wireless, it just kind of set him free. To do, if you look at some of the footage of Jagger in the 70s, he's kind of more constrained. He doesn't go as crazy as he does now, or in the last 30 years.
He's amazing, and, you know, my favorite musician, you know, because George is no longer with us. Keith, I mean, come on. Keith Richards is the personification of the term rock and roll.
Of cool, yeah. The embodiment,
you know,
of cool.
I mean, he is, that's it.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the guy. I mean, you cannot get, and the thing I like about Keith, he's really honest. You know, he's really, he doesn't, he's not a guy that puts on, although he loves being Keith Richards. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I mean, he's so honest and he's really smart, and the stuff that comes out of his mouth, you know, there's a book. I don't know if you're a Keith fan.
Big Keith fan.
I think it's either The World. It's a book that has all these different quotes, The Wisdom of Keith Richards, something like that. But it has all these different quotes from Keith over the years that apply to different circumstances.
Right.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. Yeah. So if you're a fan, you'll like it. But Keith Richards.
I love that little quote. And I don't know if it's written in the jacket of the book of the book Life, you know, his autobiography. Where
he said,
I don't know if it was in a promo clip or whatever it was, but there's a quote, something to the extent of, believe it or not, I remember all of it.
Yeah.
And that says so much about him that, you know, he's just not what we think he is in certain terms of who Keith Richards is and how we perceive him, in other words.
Yeah, I love the man. I absolutely love Keith Richards. And of course, you know, I you just asked for the very top. But, you know,
I just wanted to throw some fun questions where you didn't. But you know what? It seemed like you had to think a lot about some of it. Some of those things are really hard to come up with. We call that on Rock Under Fire. We call that gun to the head. It's called the gun to the head segment. I'm not a fan of guns, but it's the best name for it because it's almost like if somebody came up to you, held a gun to your head and said, quick, favorite band, you know, quick,
well, yeah, that's,
you know, the Beatles,
like,
or the Stones,
Soul.
Quick.
I mean, Rubber Soul, though, that is an accurate answer.
Yeah.
Although there's so many that I love.
Right.
But, I mean, it was right as, they were transitioning, from this poppy band. And they started being a little more experimental, but it was still very organic.
Yeah.
You know, I just love.
I've always thought of those records, Rubber Soul and Revolver. I've always thought of as twins. You know,
yeah.
They were just kind of, they're so much alike in that sense that they were kind of like maybe the purest Beatles records, where they were still blossoming, they were still unfolding, and they were still kind of writing together before they kind of went out.
Yeah.
Started writing for themselves.
And it wasn't yet all the psychedelic stuff, and, you know, it was still...
They were right on the cusp, you know?
Yeah, it was still... I think the pot was influencing it more than acid.
Yeah.
The pot era, or hash, you know, and or I should say hash.
Yeah.
Hadn't gotten into the heavy psychedelics yet.
Yeah.
But starting to, maybe a couple of doses, but not quite there yet.
Right, right. Bob Dylan hadn't taken hold of them just yet. Actually, he had, but...
Yeah, well, he turned them on to pot, not psychedelics.
Yeah. So you figure Rubber Soul's late 65, Dylan's got Highway 61 out. So, you know, it was 66, I guess, where Revolver and Blonde on Blonde come out. Then it's a different story.
Yeah.
But anyway, you're now one of the major voices on Sirius XM. I'm one of those people that I avoid most of the Sirius programming, and I kind of immediately go to the beginning of the dial, and I go for the 70s and the 80s, you know, 70s on 7, 80s on 8, you know. And I grew up with CBS FM in my house, where my mother, who grew up on the doo-wop stuff, she was that was her oldies, and the 1950s were already, you know, 25 to 30 years in the past. We've become, and I mean you and me, even though we're separated by a few years, we've become the demographic for what constitutes the oldies now. So it's kind of bittersweet, because on the other hand, it's nice to go to the 80s on 8 and be surrounded by all these familiar voices and sounds of a time of actual originality and actual artistry. and just an overall collective sense of humanism, you know, and that nostalgia is a comforting and beautiful thing in an age when things are just so fucked up.
Yep.
You know, and Nina Blackwood, your input is invaluable. You're a firsthand account to history, and that's why it was so important to have you help out with this episode. So thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me, and it was great. It was nice to talk to you.
Awesome.
One of our favorite subjects,
yes,
rock and roll.
And we will be listening on the receiving end of the dial. Rock and roll, baby.
Yep, you got it.
Keeps pouring on me. Bad news keeps pouring on me.